Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily and sometimes more than daily politics podcast. I'm John Connolly and I'm joined today by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Now, today probably felt like the first properly back-to-school day for the House of Commons as we had the first PMQs of the year. Boris Johnson faced off against Jeremy Corbyn and the discussion was mainly dominated by talk of Iran. Now, I guess James starts us off. What line of attack was Corbyn really using on Iran against Boris Johnson this time?
It was a kind of predictable Jeremy Corbyn series of questions about whether the US action was legal or not. And whatever was striking to me was how Boris Johnson toughened up his position. He said of Soleimani, he had the blood of British soldiers on his hands. Well, he didn't say the US was right to kill him or anything like that. He definitely toughened his rhetoric. But at the same time, he emphasised how the UK had been part of this EU, European attempt to de-escalate the situation. And I think if, as appears to be the case, last night's Iranian retaliation, Boris Johnson said it doesn't appear to have killed any UK or US troops, and it looks like the Iranians almost deliberately fired so as not to hit anybody, then I think that's just that this crisis is heading to an end. And I think that, but perhaps more by luck than by design, Boris Johnson has got through this. He has kept a low profile for today's first public appearance, and he's avoided a kind of public break with the Trump administration. This is the coffee being poured, by the way, just to reassure you.
Yeah, it's very much a Coffee House Shots podcast today. But you've got mugs, not shot glasses, Cindy.
He kept a low profile. He's avoided a kind of breach with the Trump administration, and he's also managed to kind of emphasise ahead of the Brexit talks to the French and the Germans, there's still lots of diplomatic and security things we want to do together, even after Brexit.
Katie, do you think it's kind of a slightly odd choice of topic for Corbyn to go down? I know he was called out, I think, over his appearances on Press TV, the Iranian state broadcaster.
I think it's odd if you look at Jeremy Corbyn's position on Iran and question it, but I don't think it's surprising in the sense that as Labour leader, it has often been the case that Jeremy Corbyn is actually far more passionate about foreign policy than domestic policy. It's an area in which he and his team have very strong interests, and you also see it just by the speed at which often tweets will appear on Jeremy Corbyn's Twitter account when something happens and they want to blame Israel, and something happens with the US and Iran, where they, instinctively tend to lean to the side of supporting Iran. I think that if you look at the exchange, ultimately, we already knew what Jeremy Corbyn's position is on this, and I think that it wasn't that illuminating in that sense. And as James says, you did see Boris Johnson, I suppose, trying to move closer to supporting America, not by giving, a firm commitment they were going to do anything, but just, I think, in tone of language, which I think is interesting when you think about the fact that, the UK doesn't want to fall out with the US over this. Now, Jeremy Corbyn mentioned this idea that he suggested the reason Boris Johnson wasn't taking a stronger stance against America on this when he was questioning the legality of the assassination. And Boris Johnson said, actually, the legality isn't an issue for the UK to look into because ultimately it wasn't the UK that was part of this. But he started talking about the fact that he thought this could be because Boris Johnson wants to get a trade deal with the US because of Brexit. Now, Boris Johnson's very quick to dismiss this and say, I knew you'd say this is a load of rubbish. Now, I don't think this is front and centre of the UK's mind, but ultimately it is the case that the UK does not want to fall out with America over this if they can avoid it, but they also don't want to de-escalate. So if this crisis is coming to an end, as James touched on, I think that is the balancing act, the walking on a tightrope has worked. If this is just the beginning, because while we have had this attack, figures in Iran have suggested there could be more to come, then I think it gets trickier for the UK. I think Boris Johnson very much said to draw a line under this.
And James, in your Coffeehouse blog after PMQs, you mentioned that Corbyn kind of failed to land a blow on Boris Johnson over Iran, but it was actually the SNP who are looking a bit more dangerous at PMQs. Can you sort of say why?
The SNP have a consistent tactic now with Boris Johnson. They have an increased number of MPs and they all put in for speak and they all basically ask the same question, which is why will you not allow the people of Scotland to have IndyRef too? Now, this doesn't make for great viewing, but it's quite effective. It forces Boris Johnson back onto the defensive all the time. And at the moment, he's got a perfectly decent answer about people of Scotland voted in 2014. What I think this is a reminder of is something that, that Katie's written about in the Christmas issue of the magazine. This is probably not still on sale in all good news
editions. I think it's on eBay.
On eBay.
For double the cover price, I heard.
No, which is, you know, this line holds and works. It's much harder to hold this line if, in the Hollywood elections in 2021, the SNP and the Greens win a majority on an explicit commitment to a second independence referendum. Then I think it's much harder to say, we've had the referendum, it was meant to be once in a generation, what are you doing? I think it's also harder because Boris Johnson is so determined to say that Brexit will happen the 31st of January, and also that he's not extending the transition arrangement, because one of the other arguments could be, look, don't Scottish voters deserve to know what the final relationship is between the UK and the EU before making any decision on independence? If Boris Johnson is saying, well, no, we've done all that, then, and you then get this vote in May 2021, that becomes harder. I mean, I think this is quite clear that the SNP are just going to maintain this tactic. I mean, there were three SNP MPs who essentially asked the same question. Ian Blackford asked the same question twice because he gets two questions. What they are hoping for is a kind of snapping of patience in the chamber, because they think that that benefits them. You know, look at these arrogant English Tories saying, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, you did get the sense that Boris Johnson was slightly worn down by the end of it, you know, when it came up yet
anyone
again.
Listen to Ian Blackford, to be fair.
Yeah, and he found himself having to just repeat the same answer. So I do think that it could put strain on the position, but ultimately I think the crunch point is the Scottish Parliament election in 2021. If there's a majority in favour of independence parties that are senior Scottish Conservatives who think it is a much harder position to uphold saying never a referendum, and, you know, whatever people define as a generation on that.
Which is also maybe make a nod towards the fact it was the beginning of a new era, this PMQs, with the end of John Bercow's tenure and the beginning of Lindsay Hoyle. Katie, was there a big difference between the sort of the two speakers this time?
I mean, I think the most notable difference was time. I've got quite used to making plans for quite far past one on Wednesdays, but we were done by 12:31, or that at least that's when the last question was called. It's a much faster, brisker session. And you had this moment at the end when Michael Fabricant, the Conservative MP, was just so happy about it. They had to make a point of order and say, I would just like to point out the time that we have read every single question or order paper, and we've managed to get some more in. And, you know, so I don't get the impression too many MPs are missing John Bercow's presence. I also think that in Boris Johnson, you have someone who doesn't want to spend all day talking. So I do think we are heading to a faster-paced Prime Minister's questions. I think it's still an issue of how you get scrutiny, but I don't think the length of time is really even necessarily the answer to that. It's the skill in the terms of questions and how you frame them, and that's how you apply scrutiny in this. So I saw some people saying it should be longer, but I think it's really up to opposition leader, up to backbench MPs to make the most of the time.
And moving elsewhere in London today, the new EU Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, gave a speech at the LSE today and sort of set the tone of the negotiations. James, part of the speech sort of seemed like a love letter to the UK at certain points. Do you think this is a good start?
So I think it's a sign of a tonal difference. So Donald Tusk was very emotionally discombobulated by Brexit. He never made any pretense that he thought this was an awful thing to be happening. Von der Leyen is a slightly different figure. And I thought today that, you know, her speech was, you know, talking about her time as a student in London, all of that. But I also thought that in substance, not much changed. You know, the idea that you want to deal with no tariffs, no quotas, but crucially, this is a third point she adds, no dumping, right? And that is essentially EU code for, if you want to trade with us on a no-tariff, no-quota basis, you have to be aligned with us on the so-called level playing field on the environment, workers' rights, etc., etc., etc. I think that is going to be difficult. The Johnson government is not in a mood to sign up to that. The EU think the time pressure works to its benefit, that, you know, because Boris Johnson won't extend the transition, then, you know, he's going to have to make concessions to get a deal done. That's not my kind of number 10 view on things. And I think this dinner tonight, although it's obviously not going to get into the detail of the trade talks, I think there is quite a large gap right now between the UK and the EU sides. And it'll be interesting, you know, how will that gap be closed?
Katie, do you think there was perhaps an acknowledgement as well that Boris Johnson's threat of no deal will sort of change the outcome of the negotiations in a way? I know she mentioned the fact that I think under Theresa May's tenure, it was almost hanging over their heads about whether Brexit would actually happen or not, and that kind of has gone now.
Yes, I mean, I don't think anyone's disputing that Brexit's going to happen. We are technically leaving at the end of January. The withdrawal agreement bill is passing its final stages tonight, really, and on to tomorrow. But in terms of how it changes the dynamic of the negotiations, I mean, it's something James has written about in the upcoming issue of The Spectator. I think that Number 10 are not going to call this no deal, though, a huge leave without a trade deal. Ultimately, there's this sense that because you have got through the first stage, there are enough things tied up that I think they were trying to frame it in a different way. But I think it was still probably going back to the question of who blinks first, which we did have a fair bit in the first round, and how Brussels actually views how far do they think Boris Johnson is willing to go. But I think that ultimately, if you look at the tactics Boris Johnson has wanted to deploy, and lots of Brexiteers, even in the Theresa May government, they wanted to basically be able to threaten no deal. They thought that was quite key to putting pressure on the negotiations. They were never able to do it under Theresa May, even when she could hold off MPs from forcing through legislation to force her to get an extension. It was only ever hold off doing that for 3 weeks while I try and keep negotiating in Brussels, which isn't that effective. And Brussels just think, well, they have to wait 3 weeks and then the legislation's going to go through. So I think there is a different element. I think it is clearly what the view in Number 10 is, that that will bring a new dynamic and be helpful to them. But I still think Brussels will have some red lines. It's the question of will they blink, or will they say, actually, if you go it alone, you're going to find it more difficult.
And moving finally on to the Labour leadership contest, I think it's fair to say that today was a very good one for Keir Starmer, who not only came ahead, the official count of MP nominations for each leadership contender released today, and he came top with 26, meaning he's reached the threshold, but he also received the backing of the Unison Union, which is the largest in the UK. James, is this kind of the backing of the unions especially, is this quite surprising, do you think?
I don't think it's that surprising in that Unison are more politically moderate than Unite on the kind of pure left spectrum, if you see what I mean. And they also are a quite pro-EU union, making them a kind of natural bedfellows with Keir Starmer. I think it is a boost to Keir Starmer because he is trying to position himself as a kind of soft left candidate, right? He thinks that's where you want to be. And this endorsement helps him with that. I also think that he also wants this contest to move quickly. I thought, you know, for example, Lisa Nandy, I think, had a very good time at the PLP hustings last night. And, you know, if this was to be a long, drawn-out contest, you know, that is never good for frontrunners in leadership contests. He wants this to progress, and I think he's, you know, and he wants to essentially end up in a contest with Rebecca Long-Bailey as quickly as possible, because I think that's a contest he thinks he can win.
And Katie, Keir Starmer was the big winner today, but there's also you know, a lot of other candidates who got very few nominations from MPs. And I appreciate we're quite an early stage of this, but are many of them particularly worried that they're going to make it through to the next stage, do you think?
Well, in the magazine this week, I write about the state of the race and how it links to, I suppose, the Conservative outlook. But if you look at the six candidates, I think that it's pretty clear Keir Starmer has the numbers. Rebecca Long-Bailey is expected to quite comfortably meet the threshold too. Jess Phillips is seen as having a pretty good chance of making it through the first two stages and onto the members. Her problem is the membership. But if you look at the other three, I think Emily Thornberry sounds like she is struggling to get the number of MPs she needs. I don't think she was helped when Caroline Flint did a slight drive-by soon after losing her seat, where she suggested Emily Thornberry had been quite rude about Leave voters. Clive Lewis is struggling. I think Lisa Nandy has been struggling, but it does, as James touched on, seem as though she is impressing MPs. So it might get to a point where some MPs will say, well, Keir Starmer, you know, Jess Phillips, they have enough backers. Potentially, I will help Lisa Nandy get through. I do think there is a slight scepticism in the Parliamentary Labour Party of doing too much of that, though, because it is what happened with Jeremy Corbyn, where people lent him a nomination and then it was out of their control.
The debate, yeah.
But that said, I don't think Lisa Nandy is seen as the same risk. I think that Lisa Nandy and Clive Lewis are fishing in a somewhat similar pool in terms of the MPs who are most likely to back them on the soft left. And if you look at the calculations, I mean, one campaign said to me that they think when it comes to soft left Corbynite MPs, they're probably about 70, quite a lot already with Rebecca Long-Bailey. So I think you might be some lending of votes, but I think those three are the ones where we can't say for sure if they are going to make it through. Just on the unions, I mean, I think Keir Starmer is emerging as the favourite right now, ahead of Rebecca Long-Bailey. We had the YouGov poll suggesting that. We've also now had have unison behind him, but we are expecting him to get the highest number of MP nominations. But it's just going to be keeping that going, because there were reports yesterday that there was a shadow cabinet meeting and they're all discussing what they should do on Brexit. Now, Keir Starmer was instrumental in moving the Labour leadership to backing a second referendum, something which I don't think he wants to bring up too much when he's talking about how to win back seats in the once red wall. And he said the issue has been put to bed, but he apparently suggested putting an amendment down for a 2-year extension if no deal looked likely. And it was quite quickly rebuffed by a lot of members of the shadow cabinet, who said, have you not just seen the election result we had? If we suggest we want to delay Brexit by another 2 years, what do you think the reaction is going to be? Now, the membership are pro-EU, but I do think it suggests there's a slight tone deafness, which could trouble Keir Starmer, depending on how it, you know, emerges over the coming months.
I think the thing about Keir Starmer is that you can see, okay, he has a competence that Jeremy Corbyn doesn't have. He would bring more talent back onto the Labour front bench. And the Labour Party would probably be better at the kind of job of holding the government to account than it was under Jeremy Corbyn. But I do think this is a question which is, you know, do we really think that Keir Starmer is... I don't quite see which seats you think Keir Starmer is winning back to get Labour to a majority. But, you know, you could make that criticism of a lot of the candidates in this race. And that is why my kind of slight gut feeling is that whoever wins this contest now isn't necessarily going to be the leader who takes Labour into the next election. You know, I wonder whether we see a contest, you know, to slightly turn myself into Mystic Meg. I wonder whether you see a contest where Lisa Nandy impresses, Angela Rayner wins the deputy leadership and impresses, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, Labour under Keir Starmer aren't going very far. And maybe, you know, having steadied the ship, you then move, you know, into another contest between Nandy and Rayner or something like that. So, but I think, you know, I think that there's a long way to go in all this.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening. And if you like listening to the Coffee House Shots podcast, then you might be very interested to hear that we have a live Coffee House Shots event on the 29th of January at the Emmanuel Centre in London. I believe there are only 50 seats left at the event. So if you're listening to this, jump up quick and look on the events.spectator.co.uk website to get tickets.